When Bernard William Chadwick was called to the stand, there was a murmur of surprise. This was a name no one recognized. Bernard William Chadwick was a buyer of porcelain, fine china, and fancy goods. He was married and lived in Ealing. "You travel for your firm," Kevin said. "Yes." "In March of this year, did you pay a visit to Larborough?" "Yes." "While you were there, did you meet Betty Kane?"
"Yes."
"How did you meet her?"
"She picked me up."
There was an instant and concerted protest from the body of the court. The judge rebuked them for the demonstration. He also rebuked the witness. He would be grateful if the witness would confine himself to standard English.
"Will you tell the court how you met Betty Kane?" Kevin went on.
"I dropped into the Midland Lounge one day and she began to talk to me. She was having tea there."
"You didn't speak to her first?"
"I didn't even notice her. She said she was going to the pictures and wouldn't I come too? Well, she was a cute kid, so I said yes. She met me every day after that and went out with me in my car."
"On your business trips?"
"Yes."
"Did she talk about her people?"
"Yes, she said no one took any notice of her. She had a long string of complaints about her home." Robert saw Mrs. Wynne cover her face with her hands. Her son, Leslie, sitting beside her, looked unbelieving and blank.
"And how long did this idyll in Larborough persist?"
"I was due to fly to Copenhagen on business, and she asked me to take her with me. I said nothing doing. She was only 16, after all."
"She told you she was 16?
"Yes."
"You had no idea that she was still only 15?
"No."
"So when she made the suggestion that she should go with you, you considered her an inexperienced child of 16?
"Yes."
"Why did you change your mind about her?"
"She convinced me she wasn't."
"So, in the end, you took her abroad?"
"Yes."
"As your wife?"
"As my wife."
"Do you remember the date?"
"Yes, I picked her up at a coach stop in Maneshill on the afternoon of March the 28th.
"Where did you stay in Copenhagen?"
"At the Red Shoes Hotel."
"For how long?"
"A fortnight."
"And then?"
"We returned to England on the 15th of April. She had told me that she was due home on the 16th, but on the way over on the boat, she told me that she had actually been due home on the 11th and would now have been missing for 4 days."
"Did she say why she had misled you?"
"Yes, so that it would be impossible for her to go home. She said she was going to write to her people and say that she had a job and that they were not to look for her or worry about her."
"She had no compunction about the suffering that would cause?"
"No. She said her home bored her so much she could scream." Against his will, Robert's eyes went again to Mrs. Wynne. This was crucifixion for her.
"So?" Kevin asked.
"So," Chadwick went on, "I decided the best thing to do would be to take her to my bungalow on the river near Bourne End. Except in the summer, we use it only rarely. For a week after that, I spent most nights at the bungalow."
"And how did the situation end?"
"I went down one night and found she had gone."
"You learned later where and why?"
"Yes," Chadwick said.
Kevin sat down and Miles Allison got up.
"Mr. Chadwick, this case has been a matter for comment for the past 3 weeks or thereabouts. Why did you not go to the police?"
"Because I have been abroad again. For my firm, I knew nothing about this case until a couple of days ago."
"I see. You have heard the doctor's evidence as to the condition in which she arrived home?"
"Yes."
"Did you beat the girl?"
"No."
"You went down one night and found her gone?"
"Yes."
"And all her belongings had disappeared with her?"
"Yes."
"And yet she arrived home without belongings of any sort, wearing only a dress and shoes?"
I didn't know that till later.
When Mary Frances Chadwick was summoned, there was what amounted to a sensation in court. It was obvious that this was Bernard Chadwick's wife. Yes, she said. She remembered her husband's going to Labra and his subsequent trip to Copenhagen. He arrived back from Copenhagen a day later than he promised, and during the following week she began to suspect that he had developed an interest elsewhere. The suspicion was confirmed when a friend told her her husband had a guest at their bungalow on the river.
I went down late one evening, hoping I would catch him there, she said.
And? Kevin prompted.
The door was unlocked, so I walked straight in. And a woman's voice called. Is that you, Barney? I found her lying on the bed in the kind of negligee you used to see in films about 10 years ago.
And?
For some reason or other, she got in my hair. I don't know why. I had never cared very much on other occasions, but I pulled her off the bed and gave her a smack. She hit me back. Well, from then on it was ding-dong, till she tripped and went sprawling. I waited for her to get up, but she didn't, and I thought she'd passed out. I went into the bathroom to get a cold, wet cloth. I couldn't find one at first, and when I got back, I found that the faint had been all an act. She had dressed in a hurry and gone. Her other things were still lying about, so I slung them all into her suitcase and put the case in a cupboard. A couple of days later, I told my husband what I had done.
Miles Allison made no attempt to cross-examine, and as Kevin moved to call his next witness, the foreman of the jury was before him. The jury, the foreman said, had all the evidence they required.
We had better wait until the crowd thins out, Robert said.
He was wondering why Marion looked so grave, so unrejoicing. Then she said,
"That poor woman."
"Who?" Robert asked, stupidly.
"The girl's mother. To have lost the roof over one's head is bad. Oh, yes, Robert, my dear, you don't have to tell us."
She held out a late edition of the Labra Times with a stop press paragraph. "The franchise. House made famous by Milford abduction case, burnt to the ground last night. We're going to book into the Rose and Crown for a night or two. Yesterday, it would have seemed to me an enormous tragedy, but compared with that woman's Calvary, it seems an incident."
As they said goodbye, Robert said to Marion, "Will you golf with me tomorrow afternoon? You have been cooped up too long."
Robert had decided he would ask Marion to marry him when they were having tea in the clubhouse afterwards. This resolution lasted until he found that the thought of what was to come was spoiling his game. So, on the ninth green, he said, "I want you to marry me, Marion." She took her putter out of her bag.
"Do you, Robert?"
"You will, won't you?"
"No, Robert, dear, I won't."
"But, Marion, why?"
"Why not, I mean?"
"Half a dozen reasons. For one, if a man isn't married by the time he's 40, then marriage is not one of the things he wants out of life.
But that is..."
"Then I don't think that I should be in the least an asset to Blair, Hayward and Bennett. Even the proof that I didn't beat and imprison Betty Kane won't free me of being the woman in the Kane case, an uncomfortable sort of wife for the senior partner."
"Marion, for heaven's sake."
"Then you have Aunt Lynn. And I have my mother. We couldn't just park them. I not only love my mother, I like her. I enjoy living with her. You, on the other hand, are used to being spoilt by Aunt Lynn. Oh, yes, you are. And would miss, far more than you know, all the creature comforts and the cosseting that I wouldn't know how to give you. And wouldn't give you if I knew how.
But, Marion, it is because you don't cosset me that I want to marry you. Because you have an adult mind, and
an adult mind is very nice to go to dinner with once a week. But after a lifetime with Aunt Lynn, you would find it a very poor exchange for good pastry and an uncritical atmosphere."
"Don't you care for me at all?" Robert said.
"Yes. I care for you a great deal. More than I have ever cared for anyone, I think. That is partly why I won't marry you. The other reason has to do with myself. You see, I'm not a marrying woman."
"No, Robert. There are 100,000 women
just panting to look after a man. Why pick on me? Because you are that one woman in 100,000, and I love you. She looked slightly penitent. I sound flippant, don't I? But what I say is good sound sense. But, Marion, it's a lonely life. A full life, in my experience, is usually full only of other people's demands.
But what will you do?
If I don't marry you, perhaps her mocking habit of mind would not be a comfort to live with.
What had you and your mother thought of doing now that you have lost the franchise?
She delayed over her answer, keeping her back to him. We're going to Canada, she said.
Going away?
She still had her back to him.
Marion, you can't. Why Canada?
I have a cousin who is a professor at McGill. He wrote some time ago to ask Mother if we would go out to keep house for him.
I see.
Don't look so downcast, she said. You don't know what an escape you're having, my dear. The Sharps left Milford by train. Filled with misery and desolation, Robert went to the station to see them off. Marion's goodbye letter from London arrived at his office 3 weeks later. My very dear Robert, it said, this is just to let you know that we are both thinking of you. We leave on the morning plane to Montreal the day after tomorrow. It will always be happiness to remember you. Our united love and gratitude, Marion Sharp. Robert laid the letter down on his brass and mahogany desk, laid it down in the afternoon patch of sunlight. Tomorrow, at this time, Marion would no longer be in England, and there was nothing to do but be sensible about it. Then three things happened. Mr. Heseltine came in to say that Mrs. Lomax wanted to alter her will again. Aunt Lynn rang up and asked him to call for the fish on his way home. And Miss Tuff brought in his tea. It was a Tuesday, and digestive biscuits. By the time Robert boarded the plane, the Sharps were already seated. Marion's face lit with surprise. Robert, have you come to see us off?
No, I'm travelling on this plane.
Travelling? You are?
It's a public conveyance, you know.
But what for? To see my sister in Saskatchewan, Robert said demurely. A much better pretext than a cousin at McGill. Marion began to laugh. Softly. Oh, Robert, my dear, she said. You can't imagine how revolting you are when you look smug.
The Franchise Affair by Josephine Tay was abridged by Pat McLaughlin and read by Edward Petherbridge.